Welcome to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus with Bob Mendelson.
Tonight we're studying Ecclesiastes chapter 3. And it will be recognizable to you as you open the text and hear a song from the 60s. To everything, turn, turn, turn. There is a season, turn, 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 and a time for every purpose under heaven. We return to an idea from chapter 1 of the repetition of events that in chapter 1, in their conversation had to do with vanity and chasing after the wind, but in this case seems to be aligned a little differently. It more talks about a time for everything rather than there's no time for anything. It looks like time should be something with which we deal in an honorable way rather than something which disappoints in its monotony. I'm feeling a little different as I read this than when I first read it 50 years ago. We used to read Ecclesiastes. What holiday? We read Sukkot because we're in the wind. We're in the breeze of the sukkah. And we're leaning on a lean-to. And it talks about the impermanence of life. I suppose one of those things that we could hear in tonight's lesson is that idea of impermanence, that nothing is going to last forever. Although God has placed, as our version says, eternity in our hearts. But I return to our outline. We looked the last couple weeks at life being meaningless in its monotony and the search for meaning. But this time we enter into a new understanding. Life is not monotonous or meaningless, but life is unfair. It just doesn't seem fair. And if you have a child or you've ever been one, that would be all of us, then you've said that. It's just not fair. Whether it's because you got gout and the guy next to you who drinks like a fish and you don't drink, he didn't get gout. Or you get breast cancer and the gal next to you who smokes like a chimney didn't get it, or lung cancer, or whatever pain or penalty you seem to have. It's so random. And the unfair nature of what we call life is so abundant that we could get depressed. I talked to one of us this week and said, if you really want to feel suicidal, this is the book. This is the book for you, right? Because you could look at all the random happenings of life and say, what's the point? It doesn't seem fair. In this case, time is indiscriminate. Look at the oppositions, these antitheses, there are 14 of them, giving birth and dying, planting and uprooting, killing and healing. You get this idea, when do these things take place? Where do they take place? These are pretty all over the universe, but they certainly happen in Solomon's life. Solomon the king who's writing this says there's a time to give birth, a time to die. He's seen both death and birth in his life. Not only in his own life, but in, I mean, he hasn't died yet, but he's seen people die around him. He's seen war. He's seen military action. And there are people who have killed and been healed there. He's seen the gardens that he found lavish all over his estate, and people would plant and time people would uproot it. So all these chiastic oppositions, these antitheses that are here, are designed to teach us. To teach us what? It's not just a pattern of, hey, I'm going to find 14 things that are in contrast to one another. What's it about? When you think about it, there's an accumulation and there is a loss. There's a gathering and a losing. A gathering of a birth, that's a new baby, a new family. Time to plant, I'm going to bring in more crops. Time to laugh. And then there's the loss of laughter, a time of mourning, time of throwing stones after gathering stones. So you get that. There's an accumulation and a disbursement. but it's not a disbursement that seems to be, well, in chapter 1 it would have been random. In chapter 1 it would have been a hopeless, useless, out of control thing. In this case it sounds like it's a controlled loss. That is, I've decided I'm going to toss stones. I've decided I'm going to kill. I've decided there's something about my involvement in it. And I picked that up from this last verse, next to the last verse, pardon me, verse 21. You get this fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts. Look at that, 19. You see it? The fate of humans is the same as the fate of animals. Mm-hmm. Now that sounds sad. One dies, so does the other. They'll have breath, then they don't. All is vanity. Every one goes to the same place. Verse 20. What is that? What place do we go to?
We go buried.
Buried. So in the dust. That's right. We go back to the ground. And he says that, verse 20. All came from the dust, all returned to the dust. But look at verse 21. How stark is that? Who knows that the breath of man ascends upward? That's the ruach. Yes. The spirit of a man ascends upward, and the spirit of the beast descends downward to the earth. Whoa! There is a difference. So even though he says it's all the same, it's not all the same. What does that give you? The whole idea of all these contrasting ideas, birth, death, love, hate, war, peace, is to say what it says in verse number 11, he's made everything appropriate, yafeh, in its time. Yafeh
means
beautiful. He's made everything beautiful in its time. So when he says in verse 1, there's a time for everything, he's made it appropriate. So when someone dies, that's beautiful. Now, most of us who live in the 21st century look at beauty as something that is on celebrity magazines and movies, something that's proffered as, though we understand it as ephemeral, something that is that to which we should aspire. We should buy the latest products so that we have more beauty on our face and on our clothing. We should dress beautifully. We should drive beautiful cars. We should live in a beautiful palace or house or apartment. Everything about the world today is based on outer beauty. I don't know anything that's not based on that. This idea of what is beautiful misses this biblical underscore, which says everything can be beautiful in its time. So a time to toss stones? When is tossing stones beautiful? You gather stones. When do you gather stones? When you're building.
Building.
You're building something. So when do you
destroy a building?
Why do you destroy a building? Why is that beautiful?
You don't need it.
Or it's idolatrous.
We're tearing down an idolatrous high place. No, gathering stones is a building process. Time to build, a time to tear down. He says that as well. And so this is a mere repetition. This is a mere repetition. This is a mere repetition of that for emphasis. And so there is a time for everything. He's made everything yafeh in its time. I just think that's so important, that when you look at destruction or war or death, that can be beautiful. Or in our version, it says appropriate. And I think that's a good way to see it. When things have to be dealt with, that's okay. That is not the monotony of sameness. That is just the unfairness of it. We think it ought to be more to the, well, what should it be? A time to search and then a time to give up is lost. What does that sound like? How about the Philippines this week? How many thousands of people are going to be found under rubble? There'll be a time to give up as lost. And there'll be a time to get people out of it. And that's certainly what's going on in the global community just now. Time to embrace and a time to shun embracing. Why would you shun embracing?
Because you had enough.
I don't know that it means you've had your quota forever. I'm 60 years old. That's enough already. George Burns at 90 was still hugging anything that came by him. There is something to say about celebrating someone's life when they have successfully attained to whatever age they have. And you will see that in ethnic churches, certainly in the black American church, oh my goodness, and don't do it in an Arabic place filled with wailing and screaming and crying, and you'll see that in a lot of... So cultures define end of time differently, but celebrating life is a great way to go, which we plan to do for each other, don't we? So religion informs us in a lot of ways in that regard, and I think that's appropriate. There is a time to mourn, it says, and there is a time to rejoice. What does the apostle say in that regard? If somebody's mourning, what are you supposed to do? Mourn with those who mourn, and rejoice with those who rejoice. So come alongside people and be with them in their appropriate time. If they're gathering stones, gather with them. If they're tossing stones or if they're giving up for loss, you give up for loss. It's okay to walk along with people in their evaluation of life. Everything's appropriate in its time. What profit, verse 9, is there to the worker for that in which he toils? There's that phrase again, that word profit, yitron, which is only used in the book of Ecclesiastes. Fascinating to me. In other words, why bother? I've seen the task which God has given with which to occupy themselves. Yet you won't find the benefits in your toil. You won't find it there. Man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning even to the end. So no matter what you do, your human enterprise is not going to help you unpack who God is. All of the work that we do, whether we're builders, carpenters, plumbers, tradespeople, or whether we're working in the financial district, or whether we're working at the university, none of the things that we do in work, driving a bus or clicking on the side of the road, counting how many buses go by in a certain time. You seen those guys out there? His evaluation in verse 13 surprises us, doesn't it? Moreover, that every man who eats and drinks sees good in all his labor. It is the gift of God. He said something about God's given life to you. That's in verse 10. And in verse 13, he's given you work to do. That's another gift. These are like the gifts of the Holy Spirit. They're God's gifts to people. Is eating and drinking and our labor the gift of God? Yeah, definitely. Because if you don't have eating, in other words, if you're hungry, and you don't have drinking, meaning you're thirsty, I'm not talking about scotch, I'm talking about water. If you don't have substance and sustenance, then you have no gift from God. And if you don't have work, it feels like you don't have purpose. I talked to a guy last week who was playing golf, and he said that he had retired some months earlier, just a few months earlier, months ago. And he said that he's gone to Vinny's and he's made application so he could volunteer there. I said, why'd you do that? He said, I can't play golf all my life. This is going to be boring. And I thought, there's a good man who understands that work is part of life even after you retire. And I think second career people, that is those who've had a career and finished, who come along and do a second career or work in a project in a company or work in a nonprofit, find real benefit in that. And it's as if it's a gift from God. There's a time for everything. And perhaps that's the time for a second career person to do such. Look, I talked to a lady yesterday who is physically impaired and can't get out on the streets with us. That's what she'd like to do. I said, how about this? In light of what's going on in Israel, I said, why not you make phone calls? We'll get you a list. We'll start a list of Jewish surnames. We'll give you a list. You call Sydney. You call Melbourne. We'll just get you a list of Goldbergs and Blumenthals and Mendelssohns and Cohens. And let's see if you can make phone calls. We'll give you a script. You call people. See if we can send them some literature. And she is all over that like a fly on butter. I mean, she really wants to do this. I think, who else is out there who could sit at their home, donate time and their phone calls? Because that'll cost money, won't it? I mean, generally speaking, telephoning, unless you use your mobile and you've got an unlimited plan. Are any of them really unlimited? That's what we need. We need some unlimited callers. Or it's people who want to give that way. That's okay.
The prices, nearly $80.
Then the more calls they make, the cheaper it is per. So if that might be an opportunity for someone sitting at home in Tamworth or in Yass or somewhere else in Australia who's not near the Jews for Jesus operations, who wants to volunteer and help us. A telephone ministry calling, cold calling Jewish people, offering a book or literature or something like that. What a great idea. There's a time for everything and a time for every purpose under heaven. So work gives people worth and value. That's pretty clear. 14, I know that everything God does will remain forever. Is that true? There's nothing to add to it. There's nothing to take from it. For God has so worked it that men should yare, should fear him. Antoine Lavoisier's discovery of the law of conservation of mass led to many new findings in the 19th century, according to Wikipedia. The law of conservation of mass, or the principle of mass conservation, states that for any system closed to all transfers of matter and energy, both of which have mass, the mass of the system must remain constant over time, as system mass cannot change quantity if it is not added or removed. Hence, the quantity of mass is conserved over time, which is exactly what Solomon says in chapter 3 and verse 14. Nothing to add to it, nothing to take from it. So you reckon Lavoisier had read Ecclesiastes? Maybe. Now here's the problem. Everything God does will remain forever. You agree with that? New heaven, new earth. Is it consistent with this phrase? Everything God does will remain forever. Well, the Hebrew is le'olam, and that's the key. Unto its end time. Le'olam doesn't mean eternal, as in the Greek word eternity, aionion. It's not that, but le'olam. For instance, a slave who indentured himself to a master in Leviticus and did the awl to his ear would be a slave forever. But of course, that's not forever, because when they die, that's not true. And also, at the year of Jubilee, he's released. So le'olam doesn't always mean forever in the Greek sense, and that's the same word used here, le'olam, unto its stated conclusive time. And that's important to understand, or else you'll never get when Torah is to be practiced. Torah is le'olam. So are we going to be celebrating Torah? Are we going to be celebrating Passover in heaven? No, not at all. Are we going to have to dress up on Rosh Hashanah in heaven? No, we're not going to do that. These things are le'olam, unto its end time. You recognize when that is for each particular command or each particular word where that's applied, and you'll be much safer than just grab a Greek word for forever, forever, forever. That's not the way life works. Flesh is like grass. It's going to pass away, even though God made grass. But Isaiah says, God says, all flesh is like grass and it's going to wither and terminate. There's a terminus of everything, even though it says God does everything forever. But it's not forever. It's until it's over. Verse 15 is a little different than what we'd find in chapter 1, which is that monotonous sound. Verse 15, that which is has been already, and that which will be has already been, for God seeks what has passed by. There is a different connotation to it. The old pastor of Moody Church used to say, this is mid-20th century, he used to say, if it's true, it's not new, and if it's new, it's not true. Vis-a-vis biblical nuanced stuff. Wow, look at this one thing I just pulled out of the Bible and nobody before me has ever discovered it. He would say, yeah, it's not true. Because if it's new, it's not true. And he's not saying that we shouldn't do theology or study the Bible and try to appropriate things that match then to today. He's not saying that at all. What he's saying is, new discoveries? No. And it's all based on the apostolic teaching and Yeshua teaching them and what the prophets have said. The canon is closed. There's no need for new, like 3 Thessalonians written by Uncle Bob. You know, you're not going to get that. There is the book and Shengenich. You know, that's enough already. What I'm saying is, do theology. It's okay. Do theology. Look at what it says. But if it's new and you say, well, grace comes at 3 in the afternoon. I've got this new revelation that, you know, law in the morning, grace comes at 3 in the afternoon. People say, wow, that's so cool. I saw that in your weird little verse that you unpacked and pulled out. You say, well, wait a minute. Has that ever been said in the history of biblical people? No, never. So probably it's not true. But to say grace that Martin Luther discovered, sola gratia, sola fide, and sola scriptura, those were not new thoughts. Paul had written those thoughts.
Yes.
It was the practice of the people that had dropped those. So what I'm saying is, I'm saying do theology. Study the book. Unpack it for yourself. We're looking at a book that's 3,000 years old. We're not going to come up with anything new. But we're going to do theology by putting ourselves in there and saying, what's it saying to me? What's it saying to me? What's it saying to me? And what can I learn? And what can I pass on to others as a result of reading this? That's what the point is. Okay? So be on guard. And that's exactly what Solomon says. There's nothing new under the sun. There's nothing new. That which has been, that which is, has already been, and that which will be has already been. But look at the difference. For God seeks what has passed by. The Hebrew word is radah. I did some study on this today, and it has all kinds of meanings. It has pursuing or chasing. God seeks what others are pursuing, resh dalet fei, to pursue, to chase, to follow, to hunt, to pass by, to persecute, to press, to put to flight, to take up pursuit. I found those words used throughout the record of Scripture to translate radah. It's very interesting. God seeks, in other words, God's involved in this. It's not a matter of, oh, Eeyore, no, what is always has been, whatever will be is already being, so nothing new. No, because God is seeking something that you can pursue, seeking something that you can live for, seeking a justice, seeking a life that you could have. It's as if to say what is already has been or what will be already is could sound like the monotony of life, but really it is the assurance of life. That is, that we are endowed with the possibility of life because it's here. It's extant. You don't have to worry that there is life. You just have to follow the one who's pursuing it. God is seeking and pursuing life. How about you get in on it? That gives me a different perspective on this notion of time, time, time. See what's become of me. This idea of there's a time for everything. Turn, turn, turn. It's not hopeless. It actually sounded hopeful to me as I read this again and again and again. I think that Hebrew word, radaf, is pretty important. What has passed by. Look, there's wrong going on. Wrong going on in verses 16 and 17. There's wrong happening. I've seen under the sun. What is another word for that? What does under the sun mean? It's that big phrase he uses. On the earth, naturally, what's going on in human activities. It's not the divine. We're not looking at heaven. We're looking down here under the clouds, under the circumstances, in human enterprise. That's the other way to look at it. So we're not in Star Trek. We're on planet Earth. Third rock from the sun. I've seen under the sun that in the place of justice, there's wickedness. In the place of righteousness, there is wickedness. So instead of mishpat and instead of tzedakah, there is resha, wickedness. And there is no easy word for that. It is stark. It says where things should be right, they're wrong. So I said to myself, I said to my heart, that's the Hebrew, God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man for a time for every matter. And the word matter is chafetz. Do you know the word Hephzibah? You ever heard that? It's in Isaiah. My delight is in her, Hephzibah. And it's a place. The word chafetz means delight. Delight. Why it's translated matter in verse 17, I don't know. I mean, it also means desirable things, an event, pleasure. So let's read it another way. God will judge both the righteous man and the wicked man for a time, for every delight and for every deed is there. I like that better. So I'll have a controversy with the translators when I meet them in heaven. So it says, I'm talking to my own heart and I'm saying God's going to judge everybody and that makes him happy for a time, for every delight. There is something about the pleasure of God in justice that we don't see. We don't see it. Now, you see it if you're the victim, right? If you're the, not defendant, what's the other one? The plaintiff. If you're the plaintiff, you're always in the right. If you're the defendant, you're being wronged, falsely accused, right? That's pretty standard. We see it in TV shows and we see it in movies. And we probably, if we went down to the courts, would see that as well. If you go visit people in jail, you will find that everyone in jail is innocent and they've all been set up. It's all a fraud. I was just sitting in the car and the guys said, here, wait here. And I went in and they did a bank robbery and said, drive, get away. You know, and I didn't. Everybody's right. Everybody's been wronged in jail. So when a guy like Charles Colson or Son of Sam Berkowitz admits that they did wrong and that they are right to be placed in jail. It's startling. Chuck Colson was one of the 12 most powerful men in the world, they said of themselves. That's a little bit pompous, but they said that. And yeah, here's Colson, and he says, you're right, we were wrong. We did wrong. It's so rare to hear. But if you do that, if you understand justice in the place of justice, not wickedness, but if you say God's going to judge the righteous and the wicked for a time for every delight and every deed is there, if you get the idea that God's delighted to bring justice, then if you're wrong, you'll put up your hand and say, I was wrong. You don't have to sue everybody as the plaintiff if you've been wronged either, because you say, you know, that happens. These things happen. So the fate of everybody and the fate of beasts is the same. Everybody's going to die. And there is that idea of time being indiscriminate again. And I don't know. I started, I ended. We all have a start time. We all don't have the same end time. So there's a time for everything. There's a time to die. And it might be a 5-year-old. It might be a 50-year-old. How many times have you met people who say, it's just not fair. My husband died a month before our 50th anniversary. We hear these things, and you think, wait a minute, you had 49 years together? Wow, that's pretty awesome. Celebrate that. Now, I'm not going to say that to that woman or that man on that day. I understand there's a pain, and we've got a pain with them. At the same time, if she said, let's celebrate, we had 49 years together, that's awesome, I'll rejoice with them. For some reason, it's the 50th. The 49th, we would celebrate because in every 7 year, the sabbatical year. And then Jubilee's the bonus, 7 plus 1. Who knows? This phrase, mea dea, this is so customary in his speech. Who knows? It could sound despondent. I don't know. I mean, who else knows? Anybody know? You get this impression of, I don't know, and maybe I don't know, and maybe you don't know. Does anybody know? But that's not the way it is. Look at verse 14. I know that everything God does will remain forever. Verse 12. I know that there's nothing better. There is a knowing that Solomon does have by which he's able to, in strength, write what he knows. But there are some, I don't know, who knows these things? Who knows that the breath of man ascends up and the breath of the beast descends? I've seen nothing is better than that man should be happy in his activities. Sameach. A real simcha, you know. So you get this. Is he talking almost schizophrenically? I mean, he said last week that all those trivial pursuits by which he would gain simcha didn't give him simcha. Didn't give him this nachas, this real joy, this real satisfaction in life. He was searching for it, but he wasn't finding it in drugs, and he wasn't finding it in drink, and he wasn't finding it at the movies, and he wasn't finding it in gambling and Melbourne Cup, and he wasn't finding it in his wages, and he wasn't finding, there was so much in his life he wasn't finding. Who knows whether I'll find it here, there, or everywhere. That was his despondency last week. But this week I hear him turning on a 5-cent piece. I hear him changing a little. I've seen, and I think if you can rejoice in your work, you'll actually be happy. If you really can get that down, then life's unfairness and time's indiscriminate nature actually still might work for you. Now he's hinting on what's really going to give you real pleasure. He's hinting at that as he unpacks the book throughout. It's tough for us to do these in segments rather than to do this all at once, because I want to get to the end, but I can't. I'm going to let it be stark. I'm going to let it be a cliffhanger until we get to the end. So if you're listening online, please keep listening. Or just skip to chapter 12 if you want, which will be our 8th week. Life is found in God. I mean, that's going to be our final summary, of course. And the summary of all his writings. Solomon's, all his writings are summed up in Ecclesiastes 12. All his Proverbs, all Song of Songs, all of his wisdom. All his wisdom is going to be found right there in one or two verses. That's pretty important to know. It's his summary of life. Do you have a life summary? That might be something to work on before Christmas. We're going to do this series. We're going to finish the Thursday before Yom Huledet Sameach for Yeshua. Right up until then. Ki yeled yulad lanu. For a child will be born to us. What will be after him? Sheyihye acharav. What will not occur, but what will be. So will there be a state of existence after you? Now, Solomon had never experienced that because he hadn't died and gone to heaven. But he will, eventually, after this.
You've been listening to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus in Australia. For more information, contact Jews for Jesus, Post Office Box 925, Sydney, Australia 2001. God bless you.